The American History Podcast, Season 2, Episode 13, First Anniversary Special.
Welcome to the American History Podcast, hosted by Sean Worswick.
Okay, so welcome to the show. This is, as I said just a moment ago, the first anniversary of the show. It's being released a little bit early. Officially, the first anniversary is July 16th, but this is being released on July 1st because the topic is the American War for Independence, and I felt like with 4th of July coming up, this was a pretty good time to release this episode. So just as way of introduction, this is myself and Chris Fernandez-Peckham of the Age of Victoria podcast, just kind of going back and forth discussing several myths and several issues from the War for Independence. And so you're going to get both the American and the British perspective on this. The episode is a little bit longer than normal, quite a bit longer than normal. It is over an hour, about an hour and 50 minutes. So I don't want to give too much away, but I hope you enjoyed it. We had a great time recording it, and we hope to do more of this sort of thing in the future. So without further ado, here we go.
It out tons.
Sure, sure.
But it's just sure. It's running it in the background. I'm just going to close the door.
Okay.
Okay, we are live and on air.
God help us.
Excellent. That was our persistence worthy of George Washington moment.
You know, I was worried that it was me, especially because you had fixed yours. Yours had worked, and I'm like, God, why is mine not working? And I mean, the wife is probably even more technically inept than I am, which is hard to believe that that could be humanly possible. But I don't know. I just thought, maybe I looked through the preferences and all that stuff, and I said, how about updates? And it said, there's an update. I'm like, okay, let's try that. Thank God.
It seems to work well, and my wife is a Skype addict anyway, so.
Ah, so you've got an unfair advantage.
I do. I also have a small stack of books next to me, ready for when you ask any questions. And hopefully somewhere I've got some notes as well. So
awesome. I've got a ton of notes, but and then I've got an e-book here on my iPad in case I need to refer to anything. But yeah, let's do this.
Great. Well, I suppose if you're listening to this show, this is a joint show, okay? It's not the solely Age of Victoria podcast. It's not solely the American History podcast. It's a history special chat on the American Revolution. So do you want to introduce yourself, Sean?
Sure. My name is Sean Worswick. I live here in the United States. I'm the host of the American History podcast. And my specialty is 19th and 20th century U.S. military history. So this is a little bit out of my area of expertise, but not so far enough that I can't come up with a few good tidbits, I hope.
Excellent. Well, this is the first time we've done this face-to-face, and it's lovely to meet you.
Great meeting you, too.
Thanks. My name's Chris Fernandez-Packham, and I'm the host of the Age of Victoria podcast, so my interest is the sort of long 19th century history, which includes quite a bit of military history, but I'm also a bit passionate around sort of British military history in general. So again, I think this is an interesting period. And I don't know, Sean, do you want to maybe start us off with talking about the classic American myth of the Revolution and how it's taught?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I have a student who messaged me not too long, or a former student who messaged me not too long ago. And she said, you know, the American war for independence. And then she, in, you know, kind of in brackets there, she said, hey, I do not ever call it the American Revolution, thanks to you. So I think the first kind of basic myth is that it's a revolution. And it's not really a revolution. They're not trying to march on London and execute the king and change the government. I would say that it's much more of a secessionist movement. They're trying to secede from the British Empire. Now, here in the United States, if you say secession, people start to freak out. They start to go into conniption fits. Oh my God, it's secession. And then they automatically think slavery. So those two things are not necessarily related. But that's kind of the first thing, is that this isn't a revolution as such. It's not like the French Revolution, where they marched on Paris and they wanted to change the government of France. That's not what they're trying to do at all. No. And so then that leads you into other myths as well, of course.
Well, it's interesting. Just before we move on, I think it's interesting that you mentioned slavery there, because, of course, actually, during my reading, and maybe it's something we can touch on later, is that slavery does seem to be an issue underlying in this war that perhaps doesn't get highlighted or covered enough.
There is the issue of slavery, and I think it's going to depend on which, you know, like most of this stuff, it's time and place. So depending on who's asking the question, and what sources you're reading, slavery's, you know, there is that issue. And interestingly enough, and I've got it down here, we're going to talk about, that's one of the myths, is that slavery is a sin of the South. And I would suggest that it's actually both sides do have a hand in slavery and the slave trade. We get this kind of black and white myth, or maybe this black and white narrative, where, you know, the South is the bad guys, the North, they're the good guys. And it's very Star Wars-ish, you know, black suits, Darth Vader, he's the bad guy. But it's obviously much more complicated than that. So yeah, we can definitely get into that.
That's great. Because I think it's interesting, when you and I were talking about doing this the first time, it strikes me a lot with my American friends when I first meet them usually. They often say, oh, it's the 4th of July soon, you guys must be sore about losing the war, you know. And it's like, well, honestly, no, because anyway, it was hundreds of years ago. But but we don't really touch on it in our education system at all, or even it's not really thought about over here. So my kind of image of the American War for Independence is that there was George Washington. There was a lot of heroism by George Washington. There was some rioting in Philadelphia. There was some messy campaigning. And then everyone got overexcited and declared independence, and it was all done fairly quickly. And of course, when you dig into it, it's a bit different from that. But I think that there is an element of a sort of national creation myth here that we don't see in Britain.
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that you're going to get here in the United States, and that's interesting that you bring that up, because my question was, how do the British view this? And I think I might have even asked you that when we were bouncing ideas around.
Yeah.
Because I seem to remember you said that they don't really mention it at all. And so I find that pretty interesting because, well, Americans are very American-centric, or in general, not everybody. But so we kind of think, well, of course, everybody studies this. We studied it. Why wouldn't you study it? So there is that part. But also, we kind of grew up with this idea that, or at least I've had this idea bounced around, that other countries tend to learn more about us than we tend to learn about them. And I think that's fairly true, because we are very much centered on American history when we're teaching it here in the United States. But I just find that fascinating, that the British kind of like, well, you know, there's there's a couple of riots here and there. Boston, they get upset, you know, and then bada boom, bada bing, they're gone. And yeah, have a nice day. We'll see you later. You know, it's.
Yeah. Well, it's very much like that because, of course, for us, history, everyone over here sort of knows how history is going to be taught. When you go to school, you remember how your history was, and it's going to be the same thing. You're going to start off maybe a little bit on the Celts, and then you'll do the Romans. Everyone loves doing the Romans. Once you've done the Romans, it all goes a bit quiet. You're vaguely aware there's something that happened in the Middle Ages, possibly. But you definitely stop after the Romans until the Vikings arrive. Big, big thing doing Vikings, costumes, things like that. Then it's straight into 1066. Then there's something about the High Middle Ages, if you're lucky. You know, you're talking about hundreds of years just being skipped over. And then it's the Tudors, and that's the big thing. Everyone loves the Tudors, Queen Elizabeth. You know, it's a great thing to teach history to children. You know, you pull them in, great stories, good interest. After that, it's sort of, there's a hazy bit about the Civil War, maybe. That's kind of galloped through. And then you hit the sort of unlucky period when you're 14, where you will be hammered over the head with things about the agricultural revolution and the seed drill. And then just after you've gone through that absolute turgid hell, you then get absolutely rocketed through World Wars One and Two. And then that's your gallop through history done. So it's like you have crammed, 2,000 years of history into that whole time. And it's sort of, it's quite clear there are large chunks missing, and it was only after, you know, I started podcasting really that I actually really looked into the American Revolution. It's really fascinating, but it's just, to most British people, it happened and it's important to the Americans, but it's not looked at here.
Yeah. And for us, you know, it's unfortunately, I mean, you're going to get these kind of mythical stories, you know, Washington cut down the cherry tree and I cannot tell a lie, and you know, you get some of that in there, but I think one of the biggest myths, and this really comes about after in the aftermath of the Civil War, and that's the idea that the Declaration of Independence is the founding document of the United States, and that's a huge problem. And I mean, you even mentioned the 4th of July, you know. It's Independence Day. We're celebrating the founding of the country. Okay, but Independence Day didn't found the United States as we understand it today. Capital U for United, capital S for states. The document's a vehicle, again, for secession. So it's like the divorce papers, if you will. This isn't the marriage document.
Yeah.
You know? It's a secession from the British Empire. And, you know, if you look at the document, you'll see that they spelled United States with a small U and a capital S for states. And that, I think, was on purpose, you know. And I've got it here. Let me find it, because I've got the closing paragraph of the Declaration. And it's very fascinating. If you actually read it, let's see, where did it go? Blah, 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 blah. Of course, when I need to find it, now it's not here.
Let's see. I happen to have an original copy here of the Declaration of Independence, and certainly not a replica from a museum.
Oh, nice.
Which is up on the wall, believe it or not, in my study, along with one of my favorite paintings, which is actually Washington crossing the Delaware.
Oh, that's a great painting.
It really is, and that's... That, for me, is like one of those things where you can see just how myth-building and history kind of meet in this beautiful piece of artwork.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So let's see here. Blah, 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 blah. All right. He says that Jefferson wrote the document, okay, and he says that it's being ratified by the representatives of the United States of America.
Yep.
And that the United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. So there are 13 independent states.
that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. So they're not creating a United States. This is not the creation of the nation, the United States. This is the creation of 13 separate and independent colonies.
Absolutely.
And the treaty that ends the war with Britain, the Treaty of Paris of 1783, the British Crown recognizes 13 independent states.
And I think that's,
and so that's like a big myth.
That's not wholly surprising either. I mean, because we're really talking, to set the scene for listeners, about a very small area compared to what is the current United States. We're talking about the coastal strips, essentially, before you get to the Appalachian Mountains, aren't we?
Yep.
And that's really important when we look at this, is that this is very much the stepping stone into the continent from the old world of Europe. And I think long before the events we're going to talk about today, for the British, this was very much the case of, we've set up these toeholds, these little finger holds onto this continent, and those are here to help us basically extract resources from what we are going to call virgin land. I mean, you know, it's not, if you are a Native American, this is going to be a very unpleasant process for you.
Yeah. And it's interesting because these colonies, you know, when we look back, we tend to look back and we know how the story ends, or at least how it gets to this point. So we know that, well, the United States is going to become this great, powerful nation, so forth and so on, going to do all these things. Okay, we know that. But they didn't know that in 1776. They didn't know that in 1780. This was very much an experiment. And one of the things that I try to get my students to understand is that maybe you should look at the United States at least in the leading up to the Civil War, as kind of like the European Union. It's this union of states, and the states kind of have this independence and this sovereignty. There are questions about who's more powerful, the general government or the states. You could argue that, well, the general government shows that it's more powerful because it wins the Civil War. And I always tell my students, okay, that's great, but, you know, if you and I are having a debate and you shoot me dead, that doesn't mean you won the debate.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because that was something from this period that people would have maybe said, actually, you know, a just outcome after a just war is a just, you know, settlement. And
sure.
And what was that old line of Pompey the Great after the or during the decline of the Republic, when he says, "Don't quote laws to men with swords," and it's very much like that.
Might makes right.
Yeah.
So there's like, this is such a fascinating period, and there's all sorts of great issues. One of the biggest issues that of course, if you're talking about the American Revolution or the American War for Independence, whatever you want to call it, is the idea that this is all about taxes. You know, it's just a tax revolt. That's kind of true, but it's really part of what I would say is a crisis period for the British Empire.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not that these colonists are being cheap. Okay, they argue that taxes were being levied in an unconstitutional fashion, in their opinion. So it's not that they're saying, hey, you know, we don't want to pay taxes because you're raising them too high. Because if I remember correctly, even what they would have been, they were still fairly low taxes if you were to compare it to what you would have had in England.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And a lot of them fell on what are essentially some quite uncommon items, apart from some of the things that are swept up in the Stamp Act, which was obviously deliberately more widely drawn.
Sure.
I think it's interesting. It's fascinating that you pick it up like that, because as I was reading on it from the British point of view, their view seemed very much to be this isn't anything to do with taxation exactly. This is solely for us about the fact, and I'm expressing their view. I'm not having a go at founders when I say this. The view seemed to be that this is a group of fairly self-interested colonials who have been able to do whatever they want for a very long period and have indulged in some really corrupt practices with using local militias to support local governors to, you know, extort bribes for passing legislation in the colonies, mm-hmm. not paying for help during the French and Native American wars, and then smuggling goods to France fairly opportunistically at every occasion. So it, from their point of view, I think they saw it as a fairly aggressive colonial response to reasonable demands. And it's when you get into those situations, you know, people even with the best will in the world, like today, struggle to negotiate compromises. And especially when we're talking about, you know, you could be talking 6 to 8 weeks delay getting messages across the Atlantic to even negotiate.
Yeah, it's really, I'm fascinated that the British even see it like this too, because the colonials are basically arguing that taxes are being levied in a way that's not constitutional. And they're trying to come back to the Glorious Revolution of 1688 and the British Civil War and the rights of Englishmen. They talk about this a lot, the rights of Englishmen. And so the heart of all this is, and you touched on it, is the question of local control versus imperial control or central control, if you want to talk about that.
Yeah.
You can take the argument further. Virginians, as far back as the 17th century, had begun arguing that because these colonists left England, this act of leaving England rendered parliamentary supremacy not only impossible but unconstitutional. They said that, you know, hey, we've got our assembly here. We're not represented in Parliament. We have no voice in Parliament. And so our local control is what matters. We have control over issues such as taxes and regulation of trade because we don't have a voice in Parliament. So the colonists are saying that, number one, first of all, they have no representation, and secondly, that Parliament is not all-knowing. You know, you're a member of Parliament. You know, I don't know, you live somewhere in England and then you go to London and you discuss these issues and you vote, but you don't know what's going on in Virginia or Massachusetts. And so things like the Navigation Acts that were designed to regulate trade, they're saying are not only unrealistic, but they're unconstitutional. And that's an interesting argument because you can fast forward it from the late 1600s to, let's say, 1776. You can bring it forward to 1860 and talk about the Civil War and, you know, which who knows better, the local people or a central authority. You could bring it to today.
Absolutely.
Here in the United States, we get this from time to time, this argument about states' rights or sometimes what you'll hear is local control. I mean, even in education, we get it where schools will argue with, like, the school district, who's in control, the principal of the school or the head honcho up at the school district. And, you know, we always want it as local as possible. And so what they're saying is, for example, that Washington, D.C. cannot and should not micromanage since they don't know what's going on, you know, in your local community, wherever that may be, in Nebraska or wherever. The colonists are kind of saying the same thing. You know, the parliament, the king, they don't have any more right to make laws for us here than, let's say, the Mohawks. And actually, this is what Governor Stephen Hopkins of Rhode Island said as early as 1757. He said, "The king and parliament have no more right to make laws for us than the Mohawks. Nothing could be more tyrannical than our being obliged by acts of parliament to which we were not parties in the making and in which we were not represented. And so I think that's really the heart of all of this. Who's in control? Who has the right to legislate for these colonies?
Absolutely. And I, with the benefit of hindsight, of course, we could say actually it was always going to happen in some way, shape or form, that the distance was just so vast and that the sort of philosophical ties that bound the two countries were just not strong enough to actually have an integrated government that was, you know, the norm in Europe. It just couldn't happen, it couldn't work. I think what's particularly interesting, though, is that this sort of movement towards independence, from what I'm reading, it not only is it not universally popular in the colonies, but really you're coming down to a very small number of quite intellectually gifted men who are, some of them are very, very much aristocratic in their outlooks anyway, and you could pick them up, put them down in an English country estate, and, you know, Washington or Jefferson, for instance, I could see being completely comfortable in an English parliamentary debate and living the life of an English gentleman. And so there's very much a feeling that these are not men, well, Washington, Jefferson especially, are not men who are looking for anything like the French Revolution when they're doing this. They are essentially looking to replicate something similar to what they're used to in England with this hierarchy of gentlemen farmers, a bit of ancient Roman constitution thrown in, and they're not looking for that kind of revolution. But then we throw into the mix men like Thomas Paine, and I don't know, potentially Samuel Adams seems that he's sort of a bit more of a sort of populist bent as well.
Yeah.
And so already there's this tension, isn't there, when they set the ball rolling.
So there's an interesting book, and I wish I could remember the author. Now it's skipping my mind. It's called The Cousins War. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how, you know, in England, you've got the Civil War, you've got the Puritans versus the Cavaliers. I hope I'm getting that right. Mm-hmm. And then these two groups come to the New World, and they settle the New World. You've got the Puritans up in New England, and then you've got kind of this cavalier aristocratic bent down in the southern area, South Carolina, Virginia. And so there's definitely that in the mix. And I think you're right. Eventually, at some point, these colonies were going to break away. Mm. They were getting, I mean, they were far more populated than, say, Canada was at the time.
Yeah.
There's different mixtures of peoples coming from different parts of Europe. There's places in Pennsylvania where, you know, you could have grown up and lived your whole life and only spoke German, for example.
Mm. And there was a lot of immigration emigration from Scotland and the Highlands into the colonies as well.
Exactly.
And there was a lot of military activity around also the Irish as well, you know, and I'm fairly sure I came across a couple of small engagements where there were Highlanders on the British side and then Irish on the militia side. So it's definitely an internationalist flavor to the, even to the early colonies. It's not homogenous, is it?
No, it's not. And and you really touched on it that, you know, Washington, Jefferson, a lot of these Southerners very much could have fit into that kind of English aristocratic lifestyle. In many cases, that's what they were trying to reproduce here in the United States. But then you've got, and you hit it perfectly, you've kind of got this populist kind of groundswell from people like Sam Adams and others, who kind of, you know, he's very much a much more radical revolutionary than even his cousin John Adams was. John Adams is definitely much more of the establishment. And then so there you got these tensions already in the society. And it's definitely, you know, sometimes today we look at the Revolutionary War period and we say, well, you know, everybody wanted freedom and all that. No, there's probably about one third of the people were pro-independence, you know, give or take, probably a third were anti-independence. And then there was probably a third who just were like, you know what, as long as I got my beer and I've got food in my stomach and I can feed my kids or whatever, I don't care one way or the other. So it's kind of the way it is today, really, in some ways.
Let's pick up on that. That middle group, they're making a not important point here. I mean, if you are, you know, an average citizen in this period, life could be really brutally hard. You know, Jefferson, for instance, is a very rich man. You know, for him, the consequences of loss, okay, potentially he loses his property, but the reality of the rules of war of the time, potentially it's not so serious. But the average life for a lot of the colonists and for a lot of the British citizens, if you're outside the aristocracy, it was very, very hard. And so anything that imperils your food supply, which isn't always easy to get, that's not something that you're willing to support on abstract principle always, unless you've got a really good reason for doing it.
Exactly. There, you know, it's fun and games for us to sit here and talk about these abstract ideas. Mm. But for the people in the day, these are real concrete decisions that have real concrete consequences.
And some of them are horrific, because there's an account I've read after Howe, I think it's Lord Howe, has maneuvered Washington's army out of New York. And so Washington's moving back and retreating. And then there's quite a lot of propaganda about damage the British do to the countryside as they advance. But the reality is, even a friendly army moving through friendly or neutral territory, it uses up a lot of food, a lot of supplies. It disrupts the countryside. It's a major event to have even a friendly army in this period pass through you. So if you are trying desperately not to jump one way or the other, this is very difficult, because you're in a situation where both sides might well just simply, you know, commandeer for, I think it was colonial script, wasn't it, that was introduced. And the British had, Howe actually had quite a lot of ready capital that he could use. So in some ways, Howe and the British were quite lucky for certain periods. They had quite a lot of cash that they could exchange for goods. So this middle group of colonists didn't have to be quite as badly antagonized by the British as you might think. And when we get to it, it's one thing that struck me is that Lord Howe, he's a bit of a strange chap, and he clearly doesn't want to be in this war when he's in it. And one of his big onuses in his strategy is this hearts and minds approach, as we'd call it, of not engaging in atrocities, of paying as much as you can to the locals, and to see, can I actually flip a lot of the support back from the rebels and the populists, and or at least push them into neutrality enough to chisel away the popular support for the rebellion. So it's clear that even at the time, there was an awareness that this is not a 100% uprising by everyone.
Yeah, definitely not. And the group sizes, you know, of about a third, a third, a third, those are going to shift over time. Mm. And so by about 1781, it's not quite a third. There's definitely more people have jumped on the bandwagon of Washington and the secessionist movement because, well, you can kind of feel it in the air. And, you know, I jokingly say everybody supports a winner, but not so much jokingly that, you know, people are going to support a winner. The French weren't going to come in 1776 and help these guys out, because why should they?
Yeah.
If the Americans lose, the Americans, well, they'll probably just go back to the way things were. But the French are sitting there saying, wait a minute, we live next door to these guys. If we upset the British, you know, we just lost a war against them called the Seven Years' War, or the French and Indian War, depending on where you're talking about the engagements. But they're like, you know what, we're not in any position to go down that path again. And so by the late part of the war the last year or two, couple of years, you're going to get now the French coming in. You're going to get more support as it kind of gains momentum that, hey, maybe this is doable.
Mm.
But, you know, they didn't have local supermarkets like we do now. They didn't walk around with their iPhones. You know, they didn't have the same kind of conveniences of life that even, you know, maybe just the average person has today.
Mm.
And you could have been Thomas Jefferson, but, you know, your standard of living was far less than, let's say, the average American today.
Oh, unquestionably. And I think that's particularly interesting when you look at the armies themselves. We always, you know, we know Valley Forge was particularly unpleasant. But leaving that aside, you know, army life to us back then struck us as absolutely horrific. But if you were actually from the period, to be honest, this was not the worst life you could choose by a long stretch.
That's correct. And that's something that I always try to tell students when we're talking about any period, is that often we're looking back and we're saying, oh, it was horrific. But it was horrific compared to what?
Mm.
You know, and so if you're a soldier at this point, well, you know, life is pretty hard, period. You know, it's not like you're getting vaccines for things, and they don't have the same kind of medical care we do. And so life was definitely tough no matter what.
Exactly.
And I think that's true up through past the Industrial Revolution up until, you know, maybe about 1900 or so. You know, so when you're in the Industrial Revolution, even as horrific as some of the people's lives were. If you were living, you know, I don't know, in London maybe, or Liverpool or Manchester, one of these big industrial cities, and life was definitely tough. But again, compared to what, it's just a different kind of tough, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Absolutely,
it's just a different kind of bad. It's you know, which kind of bad do you want? Bad curtain number one, curtain number two. Well, they're both kind of crappy, so I guess I'll just, you know, pick whatever. It's just. And so the same thing here with these soldiers. You're at Valley Forge, that's a particularly bad winter, no doubt. But, you know, I always wondered, why did they stick around?
Mm.
Why did they stick with it? Well, I think it's partially because as bad as it wasn't quite – it was maybe worse than normal, but not like coming from my lifestyle to that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's interesting. I mean, we haven't touched on Britain yet, and I'll just briefly go on to that because it kind of links into that. When you're looking at Britain in this period, this is not the Britain that we see today. You know, this is not the Britain that's the cartoon of bowler hats and suits and things like that. This was a semi-wild country in many ways. The road network was primitive. Life was very harsh for most people. In some parts of the country, food was desperately short. Conditions probably hadn't changed much since the early 1600s. There was a very small aristocracy that exercised just disproportionate power, and there was limited social advancement. There's a very small middle class as well. So you've got the rise of these aristocrats who are sponsoring the great works of art that you see, the great estates. But for most people, this is not a reality they're ever involved with unless they're a servant on those estates. And this lack of food, it's a real problem in the pre-modern age. People don't realise that so much of the pre-modern world is agrarian. It's when's the next harvest? Where is the next fish catch coming in, and how is it going to get to me before it goes off? And so Britain has this problem that it has a semi-growing population and its food supply is not keeping up. And men like Thomas Malthus famously propose, well, this is just the law of nature. Populations will always slightly exceed the food supply, and eventually it will result in a die-off and rebalancing. And in the pre-modern era, this actually, it carries a lot of weight, this idea. And so if you are a British statesman, you must have some level of awareness that if you can't feed your population, you can't mobilize armies, you can't have taxation, you can't do your public works, and, you know, there is the specter that you will fall from power somehow. Probably not to a popular revolution, but you might be forced out somehow.
Yeah.
You know, ministries did get turfed out for being inept, and, you know, hunger riots were one thing that would disturb the peace and lead to that. And so the great trick that Europe does during this period is to expand out of Europe to seize food sources around the world. I mean, you know, that's and essentially America here for the British represents this great world of resource and opportunity. And from their point of view, and Spanish and French as well, nobody lives there because the Native yeah. Americans don't count. You know,
yeah.
and you get these unpleasant ideas like, well, if they were, I suppose they'd say, real people, they would have improved this bounteous Garden of Eden that they'd lived in, and they didn't. So therefore, it falls to us to do. And that's obviously quite an unpleasant attitude, but that's what the colonies were set up against the backdrop of, that these slithers of land were there to be exploited and to set up trade networks and provide the raw materials that places like Britain or France or Spain needed to cope with these growing populations. And out of that, they can deploy these really revolutionary armies, because the type of British army we're going to look at in this period, it's a mix of old-fashioned, but it's also quite revolutionary in its way, because it's a big change from the old Civil War ones that you see with pikes and muskets and things like that. This is an army that has moved over to proper flintlock muskets, and it's got this new style of discipline that it's used to devastating effect on the battlefields of Europe. You know, you're talking about the year of great victories that John Churchill and the first Duke of Marlborough wins at places like Malfaquet and Ramillies and things against the French. And this whole new era of scientific discovery and scientific warfare is enthusing this army. So this army sees itself as a professional force with really good officers. And then some of it is out there on these frontiers as it sees it, you know, defending the colonists who are there to grow food and chop down trees and produce cotton or whatever for manufacture. And the army is there to protect its people because it sees them as British. They are, at this point, British. You know, the army is their army, and the enemies are the French and the Native Americans and the Spanish. And so it's over there. And suddenly, of course, it has to deal with this kind of explosion.
Yeah, and that was actually one of my questions that I had was the British Army, what kind of force were the Americans actually up against? Because, you know, sometimes here you're going to get this somewhat of an idea of kind of bumbling leadership, out of touch, you know. But I have a feeling that they're more professional than maybe your eighth grade history book might have made it sound.
I think that's right. I think one of my pet hates in life is almost anything Mel Gibson has made as a film. And obviously the very famous one is The Patriot.
Yeah.
And that is, I don't know. I don't know how popular it is over there, but I get the feeling that
somewhat
the ideas it espouses there about what the British were and how they worked are probably something that a lot of people might have in mind. You know, that these are somehow, a lot of them are very stupid. They're only there as extras to be shot down by some clever snipers. The officers are all fairly, I suppose, weak aristocrats who shouldn't be in their positions. And that the only way the British do anything is just by moving in and burning things and being cruel. And that's not how the British Army operated at the time. It was a very complicated entity. And when we're talking about the British Army, don't forget that's a huge institution that spread out around the world at the time.
Yeah.
You know, so what we're really looking at is, well, the army that's in Europe and the army that's in America. And in a way, they're slightly culturally distinct, because a lot of the American troops there are actually American born. You know, they've enlisted in the ranks and they are in the colonies. You know, these are people who own land in the colonies, who have families there, and they are often on garrison duty, essentially. And there are a few of them that are pretty good soldiers, you know, and there are a few of them that are pretty dreadful soldiers. There are, as with every army, there are some dishonest quartermasters who are on the take. There are some officers who aren't very good at their jobs. And there are a couple of British colonels I can think of that are particularly... it's unfortunate they were appointed. Let's put it that way. Especially for the men that they had to lead. And these officers, wherever you were as a British soldier, your officers were almost certainly, they'd bought their commission into the army. And that was a mark of a gentleman. Yep. But it doesn't mean that they were necessarily stupid. The purchase of commission was actually, part of it is to provide a pension for the officer. So you buy your commission, you pay £500 for this commission. You do, say, 7 years, 10 years service. You sell your commission on again. You get that money back. You can use it again in civilian life. You know, it's a nice earner. And it's also tied you to your regiment. You know, you only advance by purchasing commission again. But you can only do it up to certain ranks in certain periods. There are certain bits where you have to succeed on merit and you have to do minimum service times anyway. And a lot of these officers, they've soldiered in Europe or they've read about the European wars. They're aware of the developments of new kinds of musket drill, of fighting in different ranks and things like this. So they would see themselves as sort of fairly serious professionals. And any officer, if they're a good officer, and there are some really, really good British officers at this period, the same as there are some really great American ones, you see yourself as responsible for the lives of your men. And that comes that comes across very clearly with one of the aristocrats. I can't remember his name, but he's Lord Percy. And he is quite clearly a fantastically good soldier. It is unfortunate that he is the man who was sent to relieve the expedition to Lexington and Concord after it has turned into a disaster. You know, when actually if he'd been commanding it, I think it would have been a very different kind of engagement. But this army, it is a colonial garrison army, and it's only later on that it begins to be reinforced by what it considers the home forces. So then you get what are the great county regiments, the sort of backbone of the army, start appearing. And these are from places like Kent and Essex and places like that. And they're regular soldiers. Like any soldier, they will follow their orders as far as makes sense to them. They are tough men. A lot of these guys, you know, are from backgrounds of agricultural labour and mining. They're physically fairly fit and tough, but they're coming into this environment that they're just unprepared for. You know, if you live in Britain, there's nothing to prepare you for campaigning in Virginia, for instance. It's completely, and places like Tennessee are completely outside your world experience. Yeah. So you're asking these people to do something they've never quite done before, And they're not quite sure how to do it. They have this idea. They know that they're up against an enemy who is demonstrating a lot more competence than they're expecting. Because when this all starts, the idea of these troops is going from, well, you're there to protect the colonists, who are your people, from the French and Native Americans, to, oh, suddenly the people that you've said hello to in the street every day, they're now your enemies. You know, you've been protecting Joe and buying things from his store, and now Joe might appear in a window one day and try and shoot you in the back.
Yeah.
And that's hard for a soldier. I think, you know, if you look at it today, American and British troops in places like Fallujah, for example, you know, how do you know which of these civilians that you're dealing with is actually going to turn out to be an insurgent?
And what it's definitely a psychological. It messes with your mind.
Mm.
You know, I mean, you're walking down the street. These people are friendly, but are they really friendly? Do they really like me? I don't know. And I can't imagine having been a soldier put in that situation.
Mm. And it's very difficult. And the classic incident is, of course, the what's it called? The Boston Massacre, I think you call it. So you have this group of soldiers, and I think it's someone like Sam Adams or someone like that who actually defends them eventually at trial.
It's his cousin, John Adams.
John Adams, yeah.
The second president of the United States who actually does defend them, which is interesting. But yeah, that whole thing was just a bad situation turned really bad.
Well, absolutely, because of course it's easy for us to say, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you know, someone should have done this or that or the other. The reality is, if you're a British officer and you've got, say, 4 or 5 men with you, and there's a crowd of 20 people, and the insults are flying and stones are starting to rain down on you, what do you do? You know, you can't call in a Humvee or a chopper to evac you. This is not the period that you can do that. You know, and this is warfare at this time. It's really physical, really up close.
It's very personal.
Mm.
And to sit there and, you know, they're throwing snowballs at them that had been packed with ice and stones and whatnot. I mean, man, just getting hit with a snowball is not a whole lot of fun. I mean, unless you're having snowball fights. But even then, you know, it's much more – you'd rather be on the giving end than on the receiving end. And to be in this situation where you're surrounded by these people, it's dark, it's cold. You know, they're throwing insults at you. They're throwing snowballs at you. They're throwing other stuff at you. And then somebody says fire.
Mm.
You know, it's easy to see why that turns out the way it does.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that sort of feeds into the early feelings of the British government. When it has to come up with a response to this, it can't see it as we can, as an inevitable movement to independence. It sees it as there are small groups of, you know, essentially civilian insurrectionists who are complaining about taxes and our lawful authority. And our soldiers have been, you know, insulted. They've had rocks thrown at them. British property and shipping has been attacked. You know, if you're the government, any government will inevitably probably come to a similar response to the early British response, which is, you know, they say, okay, well, if this is what we think it is, which is a small group of troublemakers in Pennsylvania, send in the troops, make a quick, hard response, hit the ringleaders before it spreads, and that'll be the end of it. No one was thinking that the other 13 colonies were going to actually throw in with what seemed like some local disturbances here.
Yeah, it does seem like it's very much kind of confined to Massachusetts and Boston. And, you know, you've got the massacre, and then you've got the Tea Party. You know, you've got the Sons of Liberty there kind of stoking the flames of revolution, if you want to call it that. And it does seem very local up until the British troops go to Concord and Lexington. And then that's when it kind of blows up.
Mm.
And I don't think the British I'm pretty sure they didn't mean for that to happen. I think, like you said, you know, they just thought, hey, we can capture a couple ringleaders. We can just end this ridiculousness and be done with it. And then next thing you know, the whole North American Eastern Seaboard erupts, into insurrection.
Mm.
And I think it's definitely a situation where things got out of control. And the British kind of, you know, you kind of see this in history when you're trying to kind of keep your hands on the reins, so to speak. But then at some point you just lose control and you're just going along for the ride.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, because when we talk about Concord and Lexington, I mean, these are seminal events, you know, these are what start it in a meaningful way. And you look at it, and from the British side, you've got this commander, Lieutenant General Thomas Gage.
Yeah.
And he has fairly clear orders. He's told, secure Boston, disperse the rebels. And that's, you know, fairly easy. But he knows that potentially some replacements are arriving from Britain, and he's going to be superseded from command. And like any general, well, he doesn't really want to go out being known as the man who, you know, failed in his mission, you know, which was keep order in the colonies. And he doesn't really believe that the British have actually taken this threat seriously enough. And it's come through quite clearly that he was of the view that if this was going to be done, it had to be done with a big force and a strong military response, or it wasn't worth the bother. Because the British forces, they were really quite small at this time, and Gage has only got a few thousand troops around Massachusetts. You know, so he hasn't got a lot. That's not a lot to work with. It sounds like a lot compared to, you know, what the Samuel Adams and the Lexington militia can pull together. But, you know, it actually, when we're looking at the areas involved, there aren't really any great roads. So most campaigning is tied to the rivers. And that means he's got a few thousand troops to hold down the whole area, you know, and what's he going to do with those? But he has this notice from his spies that from the sources I've read, at least, that the rebels have got 3 24-pound siege cannon that the British were afraid they could use to close Boston to shipping.
Yeah.
Now, this is interesting because the sources I've read said, well, these weren't British guns. You know, the British didn't have those in North America. So they were almost certainly sent by the French before the events actually started. And someone like Samuel Adams was probably involved in actually laying the groundwork for this long before it became a populist movement. So I think probably that busts one of those myths that this sort of blew up overnight out of nothing, where actually a lot of people had already been pushing for it.
Definitely. The groundwork had been laid. I mean, because you get the Congress of Albany talking about a plan for a union from between the colonies for, you know, a couple of decades before all of this. You know, you get the Stamp Act problems and everything that starts in the 1760s. And so there's definitely a lot of the groundwork had been laid. It seems like when the British press the button, that's when it blows up. But that I guess you could say the gunpowder had already been put into place. The fireworks had been set. The fuse was there, and they were just waiting for somebody to light it. And unfortunately for the British, they kind of lit it at Concord.
Well, they did. And we have this is an interesting military choice. When you actually start looking into, okay, well, what are the British going to do? They choose this chap, Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith, instead of Lord Percy, who was just far superior. And Smith is just known to be inept. This is not a guy that you would normally entrust with these kind of missions. And he does it really badly. You know, he's facing off against Captain Parker of the Lexington militia, who's, you know, a very professional veteran of the French and Indian Wars. And Smith clearly doesn't quite know what to do. And he thinks, well, I will send, you know, some troops forward and disperse the Americans, and that will make them run, because no one sensibly would want to stand up in a pitched engagement against the British, surely. And of course, it doesn't quite work out like that. The light troops go forward under Major Pitcairn. And then this sort of confusion happens, doesn't it? No one quite knows who fires.
And the funny thing about all this is that there's this idea that, you know, we just send some troops, these settlers, these colonists, they're just going to disperse. But I think one thing they have underestimated, and I talk about this with my students sometimes, settlers who come out into these regions and settle, they're some tough people. I'm not going to go – I mean, I when I was a kid, I was a Boy Scout and I liked camping and stuff, and that was all fun and games. But that's because I knew, oh, okay, it's 2 days of this and then I can go back home and sleep in my bed and have my air conditioning and my television and all that. You know, these people I mean, they're going out into what is essentially enemy territory, if you want to call it that, and because they're the enemy and they're trying to take land from people. And the people that are there don't like them being there. And they're like, well, I don't care if you like me or not. I'm going to take this land from you. I'm stronger than you. And, you know, if you want to fight, let's fight. I mean, these are people really willing and ready to fight.
Exactly. And
you they're can, not, you can they're see not this. Americans today.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can see this on the people, on the British side, that they are quite surprised. You know, they are not expecting. And they have. They've sent forward their light companies, who are traditionally supposed to be some of their better troops. You know, you don't get into the light company unless you're pretty good. But it pretty quickly becomes clear that these guys are quite rusty from garrison duty, that their officers don't know what they're doing anyway, because they give up these key positions that the rebels easily occupy, and, you know, they get absolutely hammered. And it's quite shocking for them. And I think this has like some big repercussions, because then when the British generals to replace Gage actually come in, they have to restore the British reputation after this. You know, the British have thrown away the sort of golden opportunity to say, well, we're the professionals, we win wars, we start well, we finish well. And, you know, this Lexington completely nails that. Completely.
And that kind of gives impetus to others in the colonies that, you know, if you were on the fence and you were kind of like, well, I don't know. Yeah, it sounds kind of cool to be independent, but I mean, you're talking about the British. And then they lose this thing and you're like, whoa, hey, wait a minute. And so that's going to always help recruiting, because everybody, like I said earlier, everybody loves, you know, being on the side of the winner. It's they are throwing away the initiative, so to speak. They've got this golden chance. They could have nipped this thing in the bud, and they don't. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah. And I think that it's an interesting – the other interesting thing that comes out of this is this phrase that – the shot that rang out round the world. And that's a lovely piece of military propaganda. It's great. It's nice. It's a nice myth. And I think from what you've...
Are you saying that the people in India didn't hear this shot? Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm going to say, yeah.
The people in China were like, shot? What shot? What are you talking about?
Exactly. And I think what you said earlier about, well, this was a huge boost to the American colonies. This shot, it did ring out through the colonies. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to me is that the British government of the time, and we haven't really dived into them, they are not hearing this shot, really. And the reason they're not hearing it is that the British government is essentially King George III, who is obviously, you know, the monarch, but his power is exercised in Parliament, and it's exercised by Lord Germain. And Lord Germain is absolutely, when you read about this guy, he's absolutely useless in so many ways, except he is known to be a gifted political operator in Parliament passing legislation. So if you want a legislative program passed, this is your guy. But basically, the British government, from what I can see in this period, was obsessed just with the business of being the British government. It doesn't have another purpose. It's there. It's there as an old boys club. It's there to dispense pensions and patronages. It's there to further the aristocracy. This American thing, as far as they're concerned, is just a minor American thing. And if the local commander isn't up to it, well, he seems to be whinging a bit. He's probably making excuses. Send out a proper army, it'll be fine. You know, let's get back to the real business of government. And and so this shot does not wake them up at all. It's far from it. The British government is still very complacent, I think.
And that might be another part of their downfall.
Mm.
And that was actually a question that I did have. What is the British idea of King George? I mean, over here, you kind of get him as incompetent, mad, kind of crazy, tyrannical. It just depends, you know, who you're reading or whatnot. Yeah. But there seems to be a lot of focus on King George and the Third. And my question is, you know, what do the British historians have to say about King George and his leadership, if you want to call it that, during this time period?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's a very mixed bag, depending on who you ask. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I think most people would say he wasn't very effective. I don't think you'd find any British historian saying that this was one of the top 10 British kings or anything like it.
We're not going to get the musical King George the Third here anytime soon.
But there is a lot of sympathy, actually. It's interesting to say that there's a lot of sympathy, especially if you watch films like The Madness of King George, that the view is that this was a fairly decent person who was not particularly gifted. He's part of this dynasty of Georges from George the First to George the Fourth. And he's German, essentially, in all but name. These are German kings. This is a line of German kingship. They have possessions in Hanover. This is where those German mercenaries come from. It's not that he just randomly picks them. His worldview is therefore, like his grandfather and his father, that his position is slightly shaky in a way. You know, you've had the great uprisings of the Stuart house in Scotland that, you know, nearly turf out the Hanoverian dynasty. So the view of this guy is that he has to be a bit careful. If he doesn't want to end up ousted from power in some way, he has to demonstrate that he has control over Parliament. He has to demonstrate he matches sort of the ideals of kingship and a modern gentleman. And he has to, as well, play off the various factions against each other. He has to watch out for his German interests. And he's very conscious as a king of his own dignity. And he's also very interested in things like farming, ironically. So, you know, he's known to have a sort of paternalistic worldview and this interest in agriculture. He wasn't known to history as a particularly tyrannical king. You know, if you look at some of the absolutely horrific British kings, you know, you wouldn't put him up there. He wasn't. If you contrasted him, say, with Edward the First, not the Braveheart version. Again, I'll bash Mel Gibson whenever I get the chance.
he's definitely not like Longshanks.
No, exactly. You look at Edward the First, and that was a pretty hard, tough, ruthless king, not someone to mess around with. And George the First isn't like that. But Edward the First, whatever else you think of him and what he did in Scotland or Wales, was very military gifted, very hands-on, very, very practical, and very involved in legal reform. And this isn't something that George the Third is interested in. He's not what you would say is a visionary. You know, this is a fairly sort of solid, unimaginative guy. So the idea that he could come up with the idea of something like Louis the XIV does, of a grand court with a central, shining, you know, supreme monarch, divine right of Kingsguy, that's not this guy at all. He's just not got the imagination for it.
And I think, unfortunately, the Americans kind of put him in a rough spot, too. Keeping all that in mind, you know, they have the first Continental Congress. And when I teach U.S. history, I always tell students, look, if you're going to have the first and second Congress, the Continental Congress, a Congress is not a parliament. Mm. A Congress is a meeting, at least in the language of the day, of representatives, ambassadors from separate sovereign nations.
Mm.
And so if the Congress issues a declaration or issues a petition to the king, and then you're wondering, well, why did he totally ignore it?
Mm.
Well, because if he accepts it, then he's accepting their legitimacy.
Absolutely.
And so he can't. He can't accept that. And I think that's just an interesting thing. You know, when we talk about you're getting ready to do the – or you've done the Congress of Vienna. And so that, you know, why is it called the Congress of Vienna? Because there are representatives from these independent states.
Yeah.
And so King George has no, you know, because students will be like, well, why did he just totally reject it, not even accept their letters? You know, why didn't he at least read it and see what they had to say? Well, because he can't. Because if he does, he's lending to their legitimacy, and he's, you know, we can call him all sorts of names if we want, but he's at least smart enough to realize, I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't.
Yeah.
But if I'm going to be damned, I might as well just do it, not accept the letter and be damned anyways.
Exactly. And it's interesting. Continental Europe, of course, was another really important consideration for him and the British now, because at this point they're seeing some armed uprisings. You know, they don't know how serious it is, but they are aware that they have become the top dog in Europe recently after the Seven Years' War. And that's made them a lot of enemies. You know, they are worried, genuinely. It's one of the reasons they want to introduce this taxation and increase military presence in the colonies, is they are sure that the French will eventually start another war. You know, the British are diplomatically isolated. They don't have a lot of friends. And then they think, well, if we say yes to one of the colonists' big demands to being allowed to go over the Appalachians and expand westward, well, that's going to leave a lot of a scattered population very vulnerable to the inevitable future French assault. And it was just, no, we can't allow that, because then these colonies will be knocked over by the French one by one, and we can't afford to defend. You know, it was difficult enough for the British to have a military presence in that narrow coastal strip. But imagine if the colonies had expanded out to the Midwest and then got involved in a war with France, as well as the inevitable conflict with the Indian nations. It was going to be tough for anyone to deal with that situation. And there would have been requests saying, well, why are British troops never in this settlement to defend us? We're being raided by the French. Down in the south, someone would have been saying, we're being raided by the Spanish. Why are British troops never here? And and with the best will in the world, you know, there's only so many troops that the British can actually put into these places.
Yeah, the British are basically in a no-win situation. And I think that kind of lends to the idea that I don't like the word inevitable, but it was going to – I mean, the colonies were going to break away, you know, at some point, either forcefully or peacefully. In some way, shape, or form, they were going to get their independence. And so that's kind of leads me – because we were just talking about Congress and what is a Congress. That leads me to my last real myth. And I don't know if you get it much in Europe or in England, but certainly here. And that's the idea that the United States was a democracy, at least from birth. And that's not what the founders created. What they were creating was a republic. And I mean, most of them, if not all of them, you did have, you know, people like Sam Adams, who were the more radical guys. But you get most of these guys calling themselves Republicans. And I don't mean Republicans like as in the Republican Party, but as their kind of governmental philosophy was Republicanism. Many of them felt that democracy was dangerous. And we talked about it in one of the final episodes in season one in my show, where I talked about the social – climate of the colonies. And so what was going on is that you had a lot of mixing, a lot of drinking. People, you know, the lower classes, you could go into a tavern and you'd see white and black people hanging out, drinking mm-hmm. together, maybe engaging in other adult activities, if you will. And the founders were definitely not – they were like, yeah, I don't think we want these people running the show. And so there is this fear of the mixing of classes, of debauchery, you know, all of it they saw as bad. And I don't remember right off the top of my head, but Americans at the time definitely drank a lot of alcohol. And, yeah. You know, it was just – I mean, you weren't going to go buy soda pop at the convenience store. So, you know, and you didn't want to drink water because that was probably disgusting and bad too. So
absolutely. Small beer and gin were very popular for the British. So, you know.
Yeah. That's what they were doing, you know. So when we look at the United States, there's a quote from James Madison where he says, where a majority are united by a common sentiment and have an opportunity, the rights of the minor party become insecure. Hmm. And so what he's describing is basically what's called the tyranny of the majority. Hmm. And that's something that the Americans are worried about. They talk about it. They're worried about this idea that you can get a government that is tyrannical, even though it's doing what the majority wants. And so there was not a democracy. That's going to come about more. And we just talked about that in season two with Andrew Jackson. He's all about this idea of what the people want. Now, well, at least he propagandizes that he is. I'll let the listeners decide whether or not he was really about that. He also gets painted by the Whig Party as being King Andrew Jackson the First.
Yeah.
You know, in the American system, it was not designed to be a democracy. And so you're going to have one portion of the federal government or the general government that is democratic, and that's the House of Representatives. And that was designed to kind of be like the House of Commons. You know, you vote directly for your representative. But you had indirect appointments.
Yeah.
So you had like the Supreme Court, the Senate. The Senate was originally the Senate members were appointed by each state's legislature. You did not vote for them. And the idea was that, okay, you voted for the House of Representatives. That would be like the fiery house. But then you had the Senate, which would be more reasoned and more statesmanlike because they didn't have to answer directly to the people. But you also have the Electoral College. And so all of these things are designed with this idea of not being a direct democracy. So there is all that good stuff. But well, I felt like, man, we got to at least get that in.
Well, I think that's interesting because that, from the British point of view today, the sort of the simple view of the revolution is, like I said at the beginning, you know, George Washington comes in, declares independence, saves everyone, and then the Americans make a bigger thing out of it than we can explain. And part of this is this idea that it was a fight for democracy. And I think a lot of modern British people do assume it was like that.
Yeah.
And what actually we're looking at is this was not as new an idea as people might think. Because a lot of these debates were actually, you could go back to the English Civil War and you can listen to debates like the Putney debates and the arguments mm-hmm. of the Levellers, who are making just these points that there should be representation yeah. In some kind of democratic representative government. No one apart from the extreme levelers ever argue for direct democracy, but there is this view that there should be some kind of, if you are subject to law, you should have some kind of stake in its making, and mm-hmm. you should have some way to have your, at least your property rights and your property interests represented and respected. And that strand is definitely there, and it feeds into the early colonies with the migrations, yeah. but it hasn't gone away in England. You know, there are and for government purposes at this time, we are really talking England here, because, you know, Scotland and Wales didn't have a meaningful way of influencing power in Westminster. Some of the Scottish aristocrats were quite powerful in the House of Lords, and they owned estates in Ireland. So there was that sort of aristocratic connection. But the reality is that democratic pressure is very much an English middle class event. And you get people like the philosopher Edmund Burke, who, you know, says famously that you elect a representative, and that representative is there to represent your interests, even if that is not what you have voted for. So the sort of view here is that if you're elected to Parliament, you are supposed to represent the best interests of the people who elected you and the country as a whole, even if that's not democratically popular. So, and that's still, even today, that debate goes on in the British Parliament. Brexit is the classic example. You know, you have these MPs who are absolutely terrified of saying, well, the popular vote, it's just awful. You know, it was a vote based on what looks like Russian interference, a lot of fairly dishonest campaigning on both sides, and some fairly...
Wait. Dishonest campaigning?
Yeah, it's shocking in this day and age.
That never happens. No!
I know. There was a very famous big red bus that went around the country with the phrase, if you vote Leave, £350 million an extra week for the NHS. You know, and that's like, well, you know, whenever a politician finds that much money, I'm always sceptical. But you have these politicians who are very aware that they've lost a popular vote, but probably not for the right reasons, and that this vote is going to be damaging. And under that classic formula of Burke and the older constitutional settlements of the sort of mid-18 to late 1800s, they should really be saying, well, actually, thank you. We've heard what the electorate would like. We will now consider the best way to either take this forward, or actually it's not in the best interests of the nation. And that's what they're supposed to be doing. But they can't really do that. The conventions that the British system relies on are just not coping with the modern age. And it's if you actually sit down and look at the similarities between the two governments, of this government of Lord Germain during the revolution, during the War for Independence, and the modern government, it's strikingly similar that they are both unable to grasp the philosophical enormity of what is going on, and neither is able to produce an agile response. And I think when you look back at Lord Germain's government, if you'd said to him, well, this is a war for democracy, it wouldn't have made any sense to them. They just would not have seen it in those terms.
And the same for Washington or Jefferson or any of the Americans would have said, well, a war for democracy, what are you talking about? Mm. No, that's not what they were about. Not at all.
No, and I think for Germain, I think the reading is very much this reading of sources I've done, is that their other big terror is the loss of Canada. They fear that these are actually Americans who are not just seeking to rebel from parliamentary authority, but that these people are only doing it really, A, for monetary reasons, and B, to gain Canada. And that is terrifying to the British. And then there's this added worry of the French coming in. And so for the British, it's not about an idea of we're going out there to suppress the heroic Democrats. It's much more an idea of these people are creating anarchy, and they're doing it to get rich and to try and take Canada. And the French will come in and take advantage of that. And that's what I think is one of these strange sort of tipping points of this war, which is when the French come in, it absolutely galvanizes the British. Because up until now, there is a point, I think, probably after, is it probably Saratoga. They can't win from this point, really. Yeah. I think militarily they're done, and they know it. And they are probably at this point willing to make some kind of peace. But as soon as the French come in, that's absolutely then off the table again. Because, you know, if it looks like they are only making peace because the French arrive to give military aid, well, then it's all up for grabs. And the British suddenly face this nightmare situation from their point of view, that they now have a hostile France opposite them. They have a hostile Spain fairly quickly soon after. They have a hostile Netherlands. They have this war in America that they're trying to somehow keep a lid on and dream up these responses. Yeah. And then they've got the Baltic League of Armed Neutrality, I think it was, and Russia. So Britain is suddenly gone from, well, this is a small peripheral war, to it's not going very well, to, oh my God, suddenly this is us against basically the main powers of the world on our own. And this government, it doesn't quite know what to do, because even with the huge resources of the Royal Navy and the full mobilization of the British Army and the militia, they know that they can't hold the line everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to a choice of, what are you going to choose? Are you going to defend the home island? You know, well, you have to, because if Britain is invaded, the government will fall. They'll be conquered by the French. You know, no government can just give up on its own country in exchange for somewhere else. So they know they have to do that. They don't quite have the naval resources to control the Mediterranean and blockade the French and blockade the Americans. They can't do all of this at the same time. It's just too much. They're now in this world war, and the Navy is supposed to be the British big strength, and it can't be everywhere. And it hasn't done well in America anyway during this war. And it's when we see this sort of pivot down to what's called the Southern Strategy, when, you know, the action very much moves away from the north down into the south. And that's not because I think the British thought they could win back all of the colonies at this point. It's that they think maybe we can keep enough loyalists down in the south to keep some of the south. And that's vital to us because we can keep the West Indies. And this is great, because a friend of mine once asked me, well, why were the British so focused on the West Indies and not America? Because America's clearly more valuable. It's like, well, now it not is.
Not at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This is the big thing that Britain obviously doesn't often acknowledge, especially a lot of modern British people are quite ignorant about how much of British wealth is generated in this period through the slave trade in the West Indies. And this is the goose that lays the golden egg that keeps Britain afloat, you know. And certainly Britain didn't start slavery or invent it, but there is a definite period where the British are the absolute main runners of slaves across this Western Passage. And it also gives them access to the sugar from there. It gives them access to rum, which is, you know, it's an important commodity at this period. And it has this other big benefit that if you want to go down to South America, or if you want to make a run to India without going along the African coast, you will take your ships down to the West Indies along the trade winds and then go down again. And so the West Indies are basically Britain's gateway to a lot of the rest of the world in a way that North America just isn't. It's
exactly. And it's funny because you're talking about slavery. And I guess that's probably the last myth, actually, that I've got. And that's, you know, slavery is sometimes seen as the sin of the South, that it's all the Southerners. It's the bad Southerners. I think I might have said that earlier. But, you know, slavery wasn't limited to the South, actually. Ships out of the North conducted trade in slaves. And the North is going to profit from slavery. And all throughout the 1700s up until the Civil War, you know, most of New England abolished slavery in 1789, but they did retain their anti-black laws. Mm. Northerners continued to take part in the slave trade, and you still had slaves in the North. Even after 1789, you could find slaves in Connecticut as late as 1848. New Jersey even had – you could find slaves up until 1865, up until the Civil War was over. New York, for example, in 1790 had 21,000 slaves. There was 11,000 in New Jersey, 2,700 in Connecticut. Now, definitely these numbers, because I can hear somebody saying, yeah, but that's nothing compared to the South. And you're right. The South, it was by far, there was significantly larger numbers of slaves in, say, Virginia or the Carolinas. No doubt about that. But some of the most famous Northerners owned slaves, including, at least at some points, William Penn, John Winthrop, John Hancock, Benjamin Franklin. Hmm. And many Northerners who signed the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution did own slaves. Now, the United States ends the importation of slaves in 1808. Hmm. But if you think that just by passing a law that's going to stop everything, then, you know, come on now. Marijuana is illegal, but if I needed marijuana, I could probably get some in 30 minutes, you know.
Disclaimer, do not mention that to your employer.
Exactly, but not that I actually don't smoke anything. I actually don't even drink anything. I'm so lame. Strong drink for me is iced tea and coffee. But you know, I mean, they it's just because slavery or the slave trade is illegal doesn't mean it stops. Many of the Northerners who took part in the slave trade, they just switched over to the international slave trade. But many of them also were kind of doing it, you know, on the sly there. Right. Engaging in smuggling.
Actually, can I jump in on that? Because there is this really fascinating point, and I wish I had the quote with me. Because when this Declaration of Independence is out, and one of the reactions in Britain, someone says something along the lines of, quote, "It is interesting that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty and democracy among the owners of Negroes," end quote. And it's very much seen as hypocritical. You know, there's this, well, you produce this declaration of the rights of man and all these noble ideas, but you are still keeping large slave populations. And the British jump on this opportunity. They do offer slaves freedom and pardons, and they're quite happy to raise them as irregular units.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. You know, the founding fathers, if you want to call them that, are taking baby steps forward. It's going to be a while before you're going to get equality. Heck, I mean, do we even see each other as equal today? I don't know. You know, but those are definitely baby steps. The idea that anyone would have even said that. We're all created equal. That's pretty revolutionary.
It really was. I mean, there was that quote, wasn't there? I tremble for my nation, for God is just. You know, and they know. I think the smarter members of the founding father generation know that this is an issue that is going to cause problems down the line. Yeah. This tension at the heart of the Constitution, even.
All of them. Bemoaned the slavery, you know. It's almost, I don't know, almost like you're an addict, and you know, you bemoan the fact that you're addicted to this substance, but you know, you can't break away from it. Jefferson, amongst others, you know, condemned slavery and said, you know, it's something we need to get rid of. But you know, it's my economic lifeblood. How am I going to get rid of it? It's far easier to say it than it is to do it. A lot of them also thought that, you know, it's going to end anyways, and that's because they couldn't see the future, the development of the cotton gin, and had that not happened, you know, maybe except let's say it happened 30 years later, you might have had the ending of slavery because it wasn't really profitable anymore.
Absolutely. And I think there's an interesting myth that kind of comes out of this, which is this idea that the British then would go on and abolish slavery straight away. And it wasn't quite like that. The British had to take baby steps as well. You know, yep. They abolish it domestically fairly early. And if you are a slave who gets to Britain, it's automatic. You are not a slave anymore because Britain does not recognise slavery as a legal status. But the slave trade itself is not illegal within the British Empire. Yeah. And it's not for a while until, I think I want to say 1807 or something, that they begin to really crack down fairly unilaterally. Britain declares not only is slavery illegal in Britain, it's illegal anywhere. The trade is illegal and we will crack down on it hard. And they really do. You know, you see this immense British naval effort that's really hammering the slave trade all the way up to the American Civil War. You can read accounts of ships seized in the Middle Passage and just condemned. And it's a sort of interesting historical counterfactual. Is what would have happened if, say, the War of Independence hadn't happened, and if, you know, America had stayed with Britain until, say, 1830, for example, would slavery then have been a non-issue, perhaps? Would it have been abolished?
Yeah, it's again, kind of like I said, you know, without the cotton gin, if you just have it come about 30 years later, you probably don't have slavery. And I think the same thing there, if you'd have had those two things happen. Let's say the cotton gin gets developed around 1820. Mm. Let's say the Americans get their independence in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars. Mm. Slavery is probably not an issue.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting because that's the other sort of great myth I come across when I look at this period and even some later periods, is this idea that Britain was this industrial economic colossus. And It wasn't at this stage. It was powerful, but it wasn't that much more powerful than, say, France. Okay, Spain was a bit moribund and in decline, but even Spain wasn't that hugely far behind Britain. You know, when the French and Spanish combine their fleets, at this stage they can put almost an equal number of ships out as the British. And so this idea that these are sort of simple American farmers who are fighting the mass industrial machine. That wasn't in place in Britain yet.
No.
You know, Britain does have, it does have some factories and some mills. Sure. It does have some key advantages. But I think people overestimate the gap between the military potential of the two countries at the time.
Yeah.
You know, because when you look at what Washington actually does, my reading of him is he's actually not that good as a field commander. He's not someone that you would say, oh, he's going to win every battle like Napoleon does in his early career. But this is a guy who is amazing as a leader of men. You know, if you want a commander in chief, this is definitely one of the greats in history, I think, of just getting desperate people to do these things.
But, and he's good at learning on the job.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And that's something that the best generals do, and I think you see in wars, you know, whether it's the French in World War One, every war, you know, that first year or so, it seems like the war either kills off the inept or they get fired. And then eventually you do, and Washington is able to survive because he's able to learn on the job and he figures things out. And you're right, he's maybe not tactically astute, but he can lead men and, you know, get them to do things that they would normally not want to do. And that's where he's fantastic.
I agree. I mean, I'm endlessly impressed with Washington, actually, you know, and I'm got his picture up on the wall, you know. And I think in terms of inspiration, he really saves the early period of the revolution. There's no question that without him, I think if you put, was it Horatio Gates, if that effort to have Washington replaced by Gates had succeeded, I think that things would have gone quite as well. I think he was one of those people in history who was just in the right place when...
at the right time.
Yeah, exactly. And the British just never produce anyone like this. You know, they don't have a massive economic lead. You know, if you put two men in a field with a musket in this period, they're not that different from each other.
No.
You know, so the British rely on their discipline to get up close and do these bayonet charges. And that's why this myth of these lumbering British comes about, is that it sounds stupid. But the reality is, if you put, say, 400 rebels, as they were at that stage, fairly poorly armed, behind some fortifications, which is what Washington has to do in the early period, because they can't do the complicated maneuvers, no matter how good a shot they are.
Yeah.
You know, the British know that if they can get into bayonet range, if they can take this fight close combat, then the discipline and aggression of the professional soldier will make these people break, unless there is exceptional leadership. And you see that from people like Nathaniel Greene and even Benedict Arnold, who I think he gets a dreadful reputation. But, you know, when you actually look at the guy as a fighting commander, he was good. Yeah.
Yep.
And that's why the British often come at people bang head on. It's because, well, sure, we're going to take losses. Yeah, absolutely. And that's just the life of the soldier. But if we can get over those fortifications and then get into close combat, that was a horrific experience. I said in the Waterloo episode, you did not want to actually have the angry Highlanders in close combat. You know, these were big, tough Scotsmen. You know, a lot of them are out from the Highlands. You know, they're used to raiding between the clans. You know, their clan chiefs have joined up as their officers. You know, and there's this medieval honor cult for some of them, and they're these brutal shock troops. And at Waterloo, there's a point where they are outnumbered, you know, 5-6 to 1, and the British line is cracking. And then the shouts go up, and the Highlanders' pipes playing, and they go in, and it must have been hell on earth. And and you know, these regiments like this, you know, regiments like the Irish, the Connaught Rangers, and people like that, they might not be well led by the best officers. Like the Americans, I think, clearly have the edge in their officer corps throughout this whole war.
Yeah.
But the actual British fighting troops, when they were going man for man,
they're tough.
They are very tough.
No doubt.
It's a nasty proposition. And
I think the where it breaks is that there is, you're right, there's better leadership on the side of the Americans.
Mm.
And the Americans are fighting on their home turf.
Yeah.
And fighting, you could at least propagandize that you're fighting for your home, you're on your turf, you're fighting for your own home. And those two things kind of seal the deal, so to speak. And like you said, by 1778, 79, after Saratoga, the British kind of know the game's up. These guys aren't going to stick around. I mean, yeah, we could put military rule over the whole place, but great. What's that going to really achieve? We're just going to have guerrilla warfare, and it's just a matter of how can we extricate ourselves from this and not lose our honor.
Exactly. So, and we often hear the Vietnam analogies, but I think this one really was, for the British, a bit like Vietnam, where they're committed to this war that they can only win if they can convince enough of the locals to support them. And eventually, they can't do it in the end. And what becomes very clear in the South is that this is an unpleasant theatre of the combat, you know, and both sides are pretty brutal to civilians.
Yeah.
And what is coming through from some of my sources is that actually a lot of the Americans, especially the mountain men, were a lot more brutal to some of the wavering loyalists who were, you know, leaning more towards the British than the British were to the wavering local troops.
Yeah, it could be. And, you know, you see that the locals can be really tough on local people.
Mm.
How dare you side with the enemy? You know, you can't do that. That's And so it's sometimes your neighbors can be brutal if you're going to side with somebody who's not the neighbors, you know. You can't be a traitor against us.
Yeah.
You're one of us.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, you look at these sort of portrayals when you see them in Hollywood about massacres and things. And the reality is, by most standards of the period, ironically, this is a fairly civilized war.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Not anything like what you're going to get, like what you saw at the Battle of Waterloo, which is just, man, it gets really down and dirty, which I love that episode, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Great set of episodes there. But yeah, pretty crazy.
It was. And then of course, I suppose, to sort of wrap it up, Britain has given up in all but name, and she has to try and make this peace around the world, essentially. Yeah. She loses a lot of the gains that she had previously. She's lost the American colonies, and there's this big question, well, what do we do next? Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, the national debt in Britain, it goes up by 220 million during this war. And by the standards of the day, that was colossal.
It was.
And they're paying 7.33 million annually. That's their annual debt repayments at about 3% interest. And I mean, it would have broken most countries. And what's interesting is the British, it doesn't break them. They still have the hold on the West Indies that they needed. They still have these footholds in India. So this idea that sort of, oh, it should be remembered as a national catastrophe for the British, well, it wasn't good, not by any means. But Britain comes out of the war with one sort of big advantage, which is it destroys the French economy. I mean, it wrecks it completely. You know, the British are paying 3% on their interest, whereas the French are paying at least 6%, and their economy, they just can't sustain this, you know. And it absolutely, I think it leads to the French Revolution almost directly.
Yeah, at least one of the lead-ins to it. On the other hand, Britain, I mean, you're about to have another war in 10 years. 10, 12 years down the road against the French, but yet you guys don't have a revolution.
No.
And that's because your economy could absorb it, and you could go on, whereas eventually all of this is going to come back. I mean, the French spent a lot of money, and it's going to come back, kind of bite them in the rear end. Yeah. It's kind of, I guess, for the French, a little bit of a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, it's, again, one of those things that sometimes gets skimmed over is just how important the French were to this revolution.
Yeah.
And,
And the end. Yeah. Well, part of that too is because you don't want to touch on the importance of other actors, because then it diminishes the national creation myth. And kind of this idea that, well, we did it to ourselves. Well, yeah, but, part of it is too, you're at the right place at the right time. You know, and secondly, you had some help when you needed it. Sure, you did the heavy lifting, but, you know, you did get some assistance there, and that assistance was important.
Oh, absolutely. And I think actually that's one of the most frustrating things, is that people sometimes think that by setting out history accurately, you're somehow diminishing things. It's just, well, yeah. No, you're not. You're telling it how it actually was, and you know, Washington's achievements are just as astonishing, getting that army across the Delaware, you know, whether the French help later or not, you know.
Exactly.
There are still moments of astonishing heroism on both sides. It doesn't need to be this sort of triumphal procession myth to be really amazing.
Exactly. And I like it better when it's more complicated and dirty, and I don't like these cartoon versions where it's just, you know, let's all worship at the altar of, you know, X, Y, and Z, and oh, it was just so perfect. And this way it's much, much more interesting, I think.
Oh, I completely agree. And I mean, it's funny to see just how quickly that Britain and America managed to come to what is a fairly good sometimes antagonistic, but mostly fairly good working relationship quite quickly. Whereas the thing that really jumps out at you after this war is that the main blame is dumped squarely on the French. So the British loathe the French for this. It's yeah. not forgotten or forgiven.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Americans and the British are here and there, up through the 19th century. But, I mean, only a century or so of maybe somewhat antagonistic, somewhat non-antagonistic relationship is nothing compared to the centuries that the French and British had. I mean, you guys have been going at it off and on for, you know, 700 years at this point. And you still got a couple more before you're finally like, okay, about World War One, I guess we'll kind of all make nice and be friends. But, you know, it took a while for the French and British to finally get over it.
Yeah, well, it does. And I think what's interesting is that this sort of thread of slight tension between Britain and America kind of carries on until, probably if we're honest, until World War II. And then in World War II, everything changes. And suddenly it's, well, we've always been best friends. We're, you know. Yeah.
The special relationship.
Exactly. You know, that wasn't quite there in that way in the 19th century.
Yeah.
But then you now have this rediscovery of a lot of the common heritage and philosophy that underlay the two branches of the English-speaking people, as Churchill would have put it.
Yep. Yep. Fascinating stuff.
Yep.
All right. So that was our special episode to celebrate the first anniversary of the show. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it and found it interesting. Like I said, we hope to do this again in the future, and I would like to get other people to come in and kind of join me on the podcast. So look for that in the coming months. In the meantime, if you enjoyed the show, please, as always, give us a review on iTunes or on Stitcher or Google Play, whichever way you're listening to the show. You can follow us, as always, at American Hiscast on Twitter, and the email address is Sean at the American History Podcast. Until next time, have a good day.